coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media. We continue our 2024 Candidate Conversations series with more interviews from the race for governor in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our look at the gubernatorial campaign continues with the three Democratic candidates in the race, Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall-Long, Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer, and Colin O'Mara. They're next on this special edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is offering a series of candidate conversations. We reached out to all candidates filed to run in the races for U.S. House and U.S. Senate, as well as governor, lieutenant governor, and insurance commissioner, and invited them to sit down with us. Candidates in each race are being asked about the same set of topics to allow you to get to know them and compare them. The interviews you'll hear on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. The race for governor features six candidates seeking to replace term-limited Democrat John Carney. Today, we focus on the three facing off in next month's Democratic primary. We start with Bethany Hall-Long. Hall-Long is finishing her second term as lieutenant governor. Before that, she served in the General Assembly, in the House from 2003 to 2008, and then in the State Senate from 2009 to 2016. Beyond your annual budget proposal, would you be active in presenting proposals or initiatives to the General Assembly, trying to drive the agenda?
That ability is important. You know, that's what I bring to the table, being proactive. Also, I'm competitive. I want Delaware to be number one. I want us to have the best schools. I want us to have the best opportunity for economic development for all families, no matter their zip code, that children should thrive in this state. And in order to be able to be that success, you really have to be able to think differently beyond that budget. You know, of the folks in this race, I am the one person who has lived through statewide six deficits, two national recessions, ready on day one with that leadership.
Since you brought it up, I'll go to a question I have about the budget.
Sure.
Because you mentioned it specifically. History does tell us the next governor is going to face at least one economic downturn.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to every governor, sometimes multiple downturns.
Mm-hmm.
How would you approach that situation? If you walk into a budget year and the state is down $500, $600, $700 million.
Absolutely. Well, most importantly, you know, as a governor, you have to have someone who you can trust and who's ready and who's seasoned. And I am highly qualified, seasoned when it comes to understanding the state budget. You know, my other two opponents, you know, one's had a very small bucket of county dollars, $300 million or so, and the other's nicely ran an agency. Having said that, I am ready. I've faced this before. I've been there. I've been through that dance when we had $400 million recession in 2017. Also, as a member of the House, when we had issues with our budget back under Governor Minner for a portion, but then also Governor Markell. Mm-hmm. We had a big recession as well, and I was a senator then, and we had tough choices. I was part of the bond committee. I'm so proud to say that working collaboratively with the members of the General Assembly, not only do we have the Budget Stabilization Fund, which is important, we also have efficiencies. I'm really proud of our Government Efficiency Commission, the GEAR Commission. We've identified $100 million in efficiencies. That's where you go first. You go first to governmental efficiency. You look at your work technology. I'm about innovation. And what do you do about innovation? You use technology and innovation to your benefit. And I also, as a professor and a nurse and a college educator at the University of Delaware, have had to bring in funds there and funding. We leave a lot of money, a lot of federal dollars on the table. So we're going to be doing all things. The last thing you would do would be revenue generators, because we didn't raise PIT. Governor Carney's administration, Carney Hall-Long administration, we didn't raise PIT, personal income tax. And we brought...
that would be on the table if it was that bad.
I would say it would be a last resort.
I want to go back to kind of leadership style for a moment, because most governors have some kind of signature initiative or legislation that they pursue. Do you see going in having one or two signature agenda mm-hmm. items that you would pursue?
You know where it starts? One of my legacy items, Hall-Long for the long haul, is committed to early education, birth to five. It will be an absolute game changer. Now, That's a long-term initiative that we will get started. Governor Carney and I have put in the budget, thanks to members of our General Assembly, the largest investment ever of dollars in early education. What that does is twofold. That's as music to the ears of our business owners. Whether you're a small business restaurant owner or whether you're a large business, early education is free childcare for business. But what it will do for our state is a game changer. And I want that to be one of my legacy items, early education.
So you're talking about education. Let's jump into that a little bit more. And we've talked about this previously. In the wake of last fall's report on education funding that called for the state to spend an additional $600 million to $1.1 billion per year, lawmakers did create a public education funding commission to look at the funding structure in the coming months. Mm-hmm. How much would you expect that group's findings to inform your approach, or do you have a vision you would expect to start to try to implement on day one about how to deal with education funding in the state?
On day one, I understand precisely working with this commission. I have a great relationship with those who are on there, and I've lived through it, where we've come up with funding ideas, we've come up with district boundaries. You have to have the leader at the helm of the ship who can lead. That I am ready on day one. You know, you have to be prepared to get to W, because with the funding formula, to the everyday listener, it's 7 decades old, it's very complicated, and it gets very political. If you don't have the right leadership, there will be winners and losers. I know how to get to everybody's W. So the districts who might, under the wrong leadership, think they're losing, I'm going to make sure there are incentives and carrots, and we're going to get things done. So the listening audience is probably, what do you mean carrots? I'm meaning incentives.
Sure.
Of why we're going to reformulate, equalize. We did that this year. We put $63 million in opportunity funding to address English as second learners, our special needs population.
Do you see that opportunity funding as the main path forward, or does there need to be fundamental reform to the unit count in a way that either it eliminates that system and replaces it with some kind of weighted funding, or as some people have suggested, using it as a base and extending out from there and changing things?
Well, it's kind of anytime you make a systems change, you have to be prepared. You know, you don't want a domino effect. You have to be smart about that. And that's the fun part about being a research scientist. And I'm used to bringing new and innovative models here. You know, when people told me, oh my gosh, you're not going to be able to save retiree healthcare. We did that last year. You know, I championed that committee. We saved retiree healthcare while simultaneously coming up with a way to fund it. That's what we're going to do here. We're going to reform our children's education. Look at the issues. I'm going to establish an education council in the governor's office where we're going to have everyday parents, families, teachers, frontline, working with the teachers union. I am the candidate endorsed by and proudly by the Delaware State Education Association, who understands with the weighted formulas, equalization, you have to make sure that you do it in such a way that you don't pull the rug out. You have to make it such that all the districts and individuals come to various different agreements, because some will be perceived as winners or possibly losers. I don't want any losers. I want everyone to win here. There are ways in which we can do that in the funding formula.
I do want to talk about affordable housing, because that has certainly been an issue that has gotten a lot of attention in the last year or so. Where and how do you feel the state can be most effective at addressing it? And I guess what I've been asking most candidates is this a big solution issue or a creating a toolbox of smaller solutions type of issue?
Well, you know, it depends on your lens, right? You know, yeah. Everybody has a different viewpoint and perspective. But I can start by this much. Housing's a right. For the listening audience who doesn't know, you know, I got involved in this in politics as a nurse because I was taking care of unhoused, mentally ill homeless veterans. And housing needs to be affordable, but it also needs houses that all can afford, no matter your background, no matter your pay, no matter where you're coming from, you should be able to afford rent. We have to invest. We're 24,000 homes short. We need to invest. I have a plan, if you visit my website, where we're going to look at putting in 24,000 units minimum a year, working creatively, whether it's with home builders, whether it's with our advocacy groups, our nonprofit organizations. I've served on the NCAL board. I've served with other affordable housing organizations. And having led the National Lieutenant Governors, I see what other states have done. I am embarrassed, quite frankly, when I look at how long it takes in Newcastle County to get permits done, taking 2 years. And also, Delaware's Department of Natural Resources and DLDOT need to have a culture of excellence. People have strived to work toward that. I'm not a leader who blames people. I'm a leader who inspires. And we're going to work to make Delaware back to where we were before, where people wanted to come and build homes that were affordable for all.
want to talk about healthcare cost and access, because they have become very stubborn issues. Delaware has one of the highest costs of care in the nation, struggles to attract and retain providers and specialists. It plays out in a lot of areas. You mentioned one earlier, the cost of coverage for state employees and retirees. Also, things like caring for an aging population, which the state certainly has at this point. Lawmakers did work on state retiree benefits, as you mentioned, this year, as well as creating the Hospital Cost Review Board, though ChristianaCare is suing over the legality of the creation of that board. It's a long way of saying, what would you be prioritizing to address cost and access in the state? Where do you have to attack first to move the needle on this issue?
Okay. Well, if you have 3 days, we can cover it. I am a professor.
I understand I'm asking a lot here.
I am a professor of health policy. And so we could talk forever on access, quality, and cost. Let's face it. You have quality care, you have access, and your costs go down. Okay? You got to aim for quality, and then you have your access and your care. Having been on the House Health Committee, the Senate Health Committee chairwoman, there's been nothing more important. If you look at the 1,000 bills that I humbly was able to sponsor and co-sponsor during my tenure as a legislature, I'd say 60% were health care. And they were first in the country. First overdose system of care, first impact fee, first stroke system of care, chronic disease prevention. When I was told by insurers in 2012 or 13, telehealth, you will destroy the health system. Can you imagine if we didn't have telehealth during the pandemic? You need a leader who's innovative. I can see the future in healthcare. And the future in healthcare in this state is not as simple as those three tripods, quality, access, cost. Mm-hmm. You have to have the hospitals. You have to have the pharmacy. You've got to have the insurance. But at the forefront of this is the patient. Picture a wheel. The picture of the wheel, you have the family in the hub and that individual. And having those services. Workforce is certainly a challenge everywhere. But we can do better. As the next governor, I will have delineated staff and individuals who are going to be ombudsmen. I'm going to have one ombudsman for employment, another ombudsman in healthcare and education. We're going to be leveraging a lot of funds. We leave a lot of money on the table when it comes to our health profession shortage area, which is Sussex County. Mm-hmm. We leave funds on the table also with some of our minority health and our Medicaid waiver. You know, when we talk about housing, Medicaid waiver 115 is something I want to bring. And to the listening audience, you're probably like, oh my gosh, she sounds like a policy professor. But what I'm saying, the basic takeaway is, folks, you need a leader who understands where to leverage dollars, both federally and as a partner in the state. I've been honored to be part of the Sussex Economic Development Committee that has worked with Tidal Health and Dr. Tam and others in Sussex, where we're piloting. We're going to bring a medical education program to the state. I've been part of the studies through the years. It's easy for a politician to sit here and say, I'm going to build a school. Folks, there's a lot to that. If somebody's making you that promise, go behind the curtain. But what I can promise you is that we will be bringing a medical education program, which means some of that may be through telestructure. Some of that may be through partnerships with other institutions. But we will have that.
Let's talk a little bit about climate change, because the state has taken steps recently to address that issue. Climate Change Solutions Act calling for the state to make zero net emissions of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by 2050. Delaware's Advanced Clean Car 2's program calling for 82% of new cars and trucks sent to Delaware for sale be zero emission by 2032. And the state has also made some initial steps to procure offshore wind energy. I'll start with just the basic question. Do you support those various efforts that are already underway in terms of addressing climate change through those particular levers?
Here's the deal. Environment's critical. I'm a public health nurse. You need clean air, you need clean water. And so with the environment, whether it's climate change that we have to address, right, or if it's an issue of lead in our schools' drinking water, or if it's an issue of toxic air fumes, we have to address that. Here's what I've learned. I have learned that solar wind is great, and we should go to that. I love reaching for, you know, the moon and we fall in the stars, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's great to set goals and deadlines, but you need a leader that also recognizes sometimes when you have to have an off-ramp or you have to have a pause. EVs are wonderful, you know, and they're fantastic. But I also know it's not realistic to think all of my apartment complexes and all of these folks are going to be able to purchase an EV in a certain period of time. We may have to move the date a little. Again, I've learned that we set goals, we aim for them. We have good intention, and if we have to modify when the time comes, we modify.
Is that something you hope would mitigate some of the people who look at these things we're talking about and kind of bemoan what they call mandates and government mm-hmm. overreach? Is that part of what you're trying to say? Because there's been a lot of pushback on these
sure.
things.
Sure, absolutely. I think people just like leaders who are pragmatic and get the big picture, and I do.
So we've been asking all the candidates in all the races about this sense that there's a stronger distrust of government and calls for more transparency and accountability. And I want to address this topic with you through the lens of the issues your campaign has had with campaign finance. In the fall, you and your campaign said you self-identified campaign finance reporting issues, hired Summit CPA to examine the situation. And when Summit's work was done, you and your campaign said it found no violations or wrongdoing and that your amended campaign filings back that up. But now we have a report produced for the Delaware Department of Elections that also looked at your campaign finances and found the reporting, it called it, quote, incomplete, inconsistent, and often inaccurate, unquote. The elections commissioner did not refer the matter to the attorney general, but did tell you to make prompt corrective actions. So the first question I want to ask you is, have you or do you plan to make corrections based on that report that was done for the Department of Elections?
Okay. I think anyone who knows me, and I said this in the fall, you know, a nurse, you find an issue, you fix it. When I went from, you know, my house, kitchen table, House race, Senate race, many elected officials advised me when I got into office, use your spouse as your treasurer. We did that. When I transitioned to lieutenant governor, we should have changed. That was a mistake. It became a lot. There were true bookkeeping mistakes that my husband made. We discovered that as lieutenant governor. We did our own internal review, as you mentioned, and we publicly reported and we moved on. After a while, obviously, probably some of my opponents and complainers went and asked for an investigation with the department.
Do you think that was prompted by your opponents?
I don't want to say for sure, but I have had some reason to believe so. But it doesn't matter, because here's what matters to me is my integrity. I have never once benefited at all from any campaign funds. And two, the fact that both our attorney general and our elections commissioner have said, you know, make amendments. There's no legal action here.
But to the question I asked, though, is do you plan to make more amendments?
Absolutely. But here's what we have to do first. That report was issued without my opportunity for my legal team to respond. And that's unfortunate. That's very unfortunate. But it is what it is. And I look forward to making it record clear that we absolutely have not ever benefited and that we actually loaned the campaign more money than we were ever repaid.
So from the accountability standpoint of this, is it fair to say that without this report, you wouldn't be making these additional corrections? Can you argue that this report was needed because the work your campaign did was not comprehensive?
I don't want to keep repeating myself on the same question. I mean, the bottom line was this. I internally did a review. 8 years of research later under an investigation is different. I dare say if you were to pull in any other statewide elected candidate, whether in Delaware or anywhere, they would find issues every time you looked at it. And it's just unfortunate that that report does have inaccuracies.
So you have mentioned the fact that you felt like you're not maybe being treated fairly by your opponent in this situation. But your opponent's not the only one who has been critical of this situation. There have been other lawmakers, including State Senator Sturgeon, Representatives Phillips, Chicochua, and Wilson Anton, who have publicly questioned what's happening with your campaign finance.
Well, I think it comes from the individual perspective. Here's what I can say point blank. You mentioned four names here. I have on the other side 40-some other people who feel very differently.
Right, but if they count, then these count too, right? Yes. They either all count or they all don't count.
They're going off of a report that was issued by a FOIA request when I was not able to rebuttal. And when my data are there and present, there's a different outcome.
I do want to ask one final question that goes to the point of transparency. And it goes back to the initial campaign statement made when the work with Summit was completed. And that was that Summit CPA, a Delaware-based certified public accounting firm, was brought on board to audit records and receipts and reconcile all expenses and disbursements from the account. While reporting edits were made, Summit has determined that Bethany and her husband lent more to the campaign-related expenses over the course of prior campaigns than they were reimbursed for. No wrongdoings or violations were found. When the report came out from the Department of Elections, the scope of work for Summit was part of that. And that scope of work said that Summit was not going to audit or otherwise verify the data submitted to them, and that their engagement does not include procedures to detect errors, fraud, theft, or other wrongdoing. So the question I have is, can you clarify, was Summit's work an audit that found no wrongdoing or violations or not?
Okay. again, for probably the 200th time I've had to answer this question publicly, we had an internal review.
Right, but your initial statement said it was an audit.
You know, press makes statements all the time that are misunderstood or misnomers.
But why was there not a walking back of that when you realized people were asking you, hey, why don't you release the audit? Why don't you release the audit?
We have released every item publicly. Tom, come on. It's been there. And you know what? I'm not going to go down this path again. You will not have a person more open and honest than us turning in ourselves saying, hey, we're open, we're transparent, we have a question around how much we loaned, we want to get that clarified, and we did.
That's Democratic candidate for governor Bethany Hall Long. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, our candidate conversation with another Democrat in the governor's race, Matt Meyer. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our candidate conversations with more from the Democratic primary for governor, where we now turn to Matt Meyer. Meyer is in his second term as Newcastle County Executive, an office he first won in 2016. He was reelected in 2020. A reminder, the interviews you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. Oftentimes when people talk about the governor, the big piece of the way the governor drives an agenda is through their budget proposal. What I'm curious is, would you be active beyond that in presenting proposals or initiatives to the General Assembly to drive the agenda?
We have a vision for where this state needs to go. Today, there are 17 schools in Delaware. 17 schools in Delaware with single-digit proficiency in math or reading. That means, according to test scores, which I know are not 100% accurate and accurate depiction of what's going on, but clearly we have a problem. That means in 17 schools, less than 10% of our students can read, write, or do math on grade level. That is not acceptable. So does that take vision? Yes. Does it take leadership? Yes. Does it mean sticking your neck out sometimes to make sure teachers are treated right, to make sure paraprofessionals are paid more than people packing your Amazon boxes? That's right. And if it means getting in there and getting dirty with the state legislature, making sure we're pushing to move things forward, making sure we're building allies to move platforms forward, absolutely. We need to take specific action. If the state legislature is like, well, hemming and hawing, we need leadership to get in there. Some of that will come from me and some of it will come from others to make sure we get the platforms, policies, and laws through and execute them properly and evaluate them properly to make sure we're protecting Delawareans.
Building on that just a little bit, most governors have some kind of signature initiative or legislation they pursue. The late Governor Ruth Ann Minnert was the indoor smoking ban. Former Governor Markell had things like language immersion and career pathways. The current Governor John Carney, Wilmington Learning Collaborative, budget smoothing. What do you see as being perhaps what might be your signature agenda items that you would want to pursue?
We got to address issues in our schools immediately, particularly in lower income communities, but also for all communities. There are too many Delawareans who want to live in Delaware, who choose to live in Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, simply to get a quality public education. We need to turn that around. Healthcare. My wife is an emergency room physician. The situation right now in emergency rooms across our country is embarrassing. Across our country. In Delaware, it's particularly embarrassing. Our goal will be to have the highest quality emergency rooms in the state and also improve the accessibility and affordability of healthcare.
Well, I want to talk about some of those issues a little bit more in depth in a moment, but I do want to get to one other thing first, and that is the budget. Because history tells us the next governor will face at least one economic downturn, serious economic downturn, where you walk in to a budget year and you're down hundreds of thousands of dollars in
hundreds
revenue.
Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions. My apologies. How would you handle that type of situation? It's more of a crisis situation in trying to balance the budget.
Well, I'm the only candidate who's ever dealt with a situation like that. I was elected in 2016, a sixth and seventh grade math teacher who suddenly was in the middle of a county budget crisis with a state government that was threatening to reduce transfer tax, which is one of our biggest revenues at the one of our largest revenues at the county, and a budget that my predecessor left me that was thoroughly out of balance with expenses far exceeding our revenues. And after 8 years, I can say not only have we had a balanced budget 8 out of 8 years, I'm the only county executive ever to actually reduce property taxes. And we did that while adding all sorts of services to the public. I've done it at the county. The way I'll do it in the state is first, I personally, with my team, need to go line by line through the state budget. It's hard. More than $6 mm-hmm. billion dollar budget. There's a lot there. And there's a lot of I found in the county waste and abuse. That you can find, hey, let's get down to what are the core of services and what's the core of what Delawareans want and need. Now, to be clear, that does not mean, it must not mean cutting out nonprofits that are critical to the service delivery in our state. Those are absolutely critical. And traditionally, in hardest times, those are cut. That is not my intention. What we're going to do is try and find waste and abuse. We think it's there. We can also find other revenue sources, both the federal government with competitive grants, but also by looking at our tax structure. Today, Tom, we are, with the exception of the states that have no income tax, I imagine we are probably the only state in the country where if you and your family make $70,000 a year, you pay the same tax rate as someone who makes $70 million a year. Right? That's not acceptable. That's not right. There's opportunities there to raise additional revenue to address a shortfall.
So let's talk about some more issues. We'll start with one we haven't quite talked about, or you haven't talked about just yet, and that is affordable housing, because that has become a really big issue across the state. Where and how do you feel the state can be most effective at addressing it? I guess what I've kind of asked a lot of candidates is this a big solution issue or a creating a toolbox of smaller solutions type of issue in your mind?
I think it's a big toolbox issue. In several respects. First of all, the Hope Center was a model. It was something we created as a pilot. We need to learn from them and make sure there are similar facilities in Kent and Sussex County, emergency housing facilities for those most in need. In addition, there's a crisis of affordability. Affordable housing developer was telling me this morning that you can't find a starter home. You cannot find a starter home in New Castle County today for less than $500,000. I know in Sussex and Kent, the situation is similarly in crisis. The way we're going to address this, first, there are a number of tools. We've done a number of them at the county in collaboration with Habitat for Humanity and others, lowering the rental cost for many families. But we're also going to look at supply-demand issues. What we need to do is build additional supply. By one estimate I saw, in the next 2 to 3 decades, 20, 25, 30 years, Delaware needs about 50,000 additional housing units. It's gonna take hard decisions. We're gonna have to look at zoning across our state. We're not gonna build everywhere, but we're gonna be strategic about saying, okay, we can't take every green space and decimate it and build houses on it. So we're gonna make sure we increase the green space while having housing units, having pathways to actually develop housing in some places in concentrated ways, in dense ways to move forward.
Let's head back to education, which you addressed earlier. When we spoke in May, you expressed support for the recommendation in the education funding report produced as part of the education funding equity lawsuit, talking about spending an additional $600 million to $1.1 billion per year for education. I got the numbers right that time. Lawmakers did, since we talked, create a public education funding commission to look at that funding structure in the coming months. How would you expect that group's finding to inform your approach? Or do you, when it comes to funding, already have a vision that you want to pursue, that you want to aggressively go after?
So first thing to know, in our county government, my staff talks about Meyer time. Because if they know if they come to me and say, we're forming a commission to do that, that's fine. Public input is great. It needs to happen fast. It needs to happen with urgency. We are right now today allocating funding using a formula that was written in the 1940s. It needs to change and change with urgency. Our policy, which is available on our website, mattmeyer.org, has been very clear that we believe that per student allocations need to increase on average $3,500 to $6,500 per student. We've also been clear that the current unit count system the state uses, where sort of every student gets the same allocated amount, does not make sense in a 21st century world. we have ideas and thoughts about how the formula should be weighted. We think there particularly has to be investment and work by my team in the governor's office, by the Department of Education, and each individual school district and school to make sure and guarantee to taxpayers that their funds are not being spent on disproportionately on administration, that funds are going directly to the classroom and directly benefiting the student.
You mentioned healthcare earlier, cost and access, stubborn issues in this state. Delaware has one of the highest costs of care in the nation while struggling to attract and retain providers and specialists. Plays out in a lot of areas. We saw this year specifically with state employees and retirees, more specifically, also an aging population that requires specialists and care that maybe is not as accessible as it should be. Lawmakers did work on the state retiree benefits side this year, also created the Hospital Cost Review Board, though ChristianaCare is currently suing over the legality of that. It's a long way of asking you, what would you advocate to prioritize cost and access in Delaware in terms of healthcare?
So one of the biggest problems I see is just a lack of providers. Doctors, nurses, particularly acute in Sussex County, where you have seniors that have moved here at higher rates than I think many, many expected, and there simply aren't doctors for them. So they have to wait 3 months, 4 months, 8 months to get a doctor. And there's some of that in Newcastle County too. So one thing is, how do we attract and retain medical professionals that we need? Doctors, physician's assistants, nurses, med techs. We need to look at residencies, the number and specialization of residencies to make sure we're attracting people. We have to look at programs that that address some of the student loan burden for doctors and nurses, practitioners, to make sure that they know if they go to higher needs areas to serve, they're not going to make less money. They're actually going to get an easier financial burden.
How about the cost side of things?
Cost is challenging because it's so heavily regulated from the federal government. Mm-hmm. You can't just, as a governor, and like with education, you have quite a bit of control. With housing, you have quite a bit of control in changing the system. In healthcare, it's more challenging, but we really have to look closely at competitive dynamics across the state. There are too many sort of monopolies within healthcare insurance. We're going to look hard at these and what can we do to develop the appropriate incentives for providers to bring costs down.
You mentioned climate earlier, and I know we talked about climate the last time you and I sat down, and the state has taken some efforts to address climate change. Climate Change Solutions Act calling for zero net additions to greenhouse gases by 2050. Advanced Clear Car 2 program, 82% of new cars and trucks sent to Delaware for sale, zero emission by 2032. And the state has taken some baby steps toward procurement of offshore wind. I know when we talked before, you supported those initiatives as they're moving forward. What I want to ask now is, what do you say to those who are balking at those efforts, bemoaning what they call mandates or government overreach?
I, too, struggle with government mandates. I think, like in the car automobile market today, people should have a choice in what automobile to purchase. If it were up to me, I would incorporate the environmental cost into the actual cost. So people can make a choice about what vehicle they want. You just have to pay the cost. Like electric vehicles, right, as environmentally dynamic and improved that they are, still have a cost to the environment. And so I like to, and if you've seen how we've worked with companies at the county, I do not like picking winners and losers. I think particularly with electric vehicles, the technologies are changing quickly. Mm-hmm. We're at danger as a government if we say this technology is the end all be all. We may actually set back innovation rather than set it forward. I'm much more focused and interested, as we've shown at the county, on climate resiliency. We, not as like an abstract pie in the sky idea, but as a practical matter, are seeing a dramatic increase in rainfall, a dramatic increase in tornadoes. Tornadoes, like we had one tornado when I grew up here before I turned 18, and we had, I think, three in the past year or two. We need to make sure our community is prepared for it. We have to make sure land use policies across the state reflect that. We have to make sure we're working through DENREC and also with federal environmental and agricultural programs to make sure we are protecting Delawareans. We also have some historic opportunities with the changing and transformation to a green economy, the massive investments, I think positive investments, that the Biden administration has made into sustainable green energy solutions like wind, like solar, like green hydrogen. We really have an opportunity here in Delaware to be the first green energy self-sustaining state, which sounds like, oh, that's wonderful for the environment, which it is, but it's also wonderful for the economy.
I do want to circle back to the issue of transparency and accountability, which you referenced earlier, because this is a time where there seems to be a stronger distrust of government and perhaps maybe more specifically politicians themselves. What role do you feel this office and you personally can play in giving Delaware a sense they're getting greater transparency and accountability?
The level of accountability and transparency by the state government today is not acceptable. In 2024, as I've shown in Newcastle County government, you need to put documents online. One of the first things I did is I did an open checkbook, which means that any dollar we spend in county government of your tax dollar, you can see it online as easily as you can see your own bank statement. As I like to say, it ain't my money, it's your money and it's our money. That's also true with documents where we're going to work hard to make sure many documents, you don't even need to wait to FOIA them. We would just make them publicly available. So we're going to look at transparency in every way. I've come out very fervently in support of an inspector general. That's an independent office that can analyze every level of state government, including the governor's office, to see what we can do to make sure we're more transparent, accountable, and efficient to serve Delawareans.
That's Democratic candidate for governor Matt Meyer. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. And we'll hear from another Democrat running for governor, Colin O'Mara, next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We wrap up our candidate conversations from the Democratic primary for governor with Colin O'Mara. O'Mara is making his first run for office in Delaware, but previously served as DENREC's secretary under former governor Jack Markell. A reminder, the interviews you're hearing here on The Green are edited for time. Full candidate conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. Do you have in your mind going in what may be a potential signature agenda item or items for you to pursue?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I do think that the most important thing is actually transforming our public schools. And it's really about equitable funding. It's about early pre-K. It's about pre-K. It's about making sure that we have universal school meals, better teacher pay and educator pay, making sure that we have better ratios. But I think education will be the kind of cornerstone. But we also need a massive conversation on affordability. You know, the fact that, you know, housing, healthcare, childcare are unaffordable in the state. So that'll be another signature piece. Environment obviously will always be for me. I think we could be the one of the national leaders on climate change and environmental justice and open space conservation. We got development kind of run amok in a whole bunch of places. And so, you know, making sure that that's a priority. And then the last one, and this may depend on kind of what happens at the federal level, but there is kind of a basic protection of fundamental rights, that things that I didn't think we'd have to be in the, you know, courts battling over, things that we'd have to, you know, put into our Constitution. But we can't take for granted anymore around reproductive rights, voting rights, civil rights, rights for sexual orientation and gender identity, rights for around the environment, rights around of criminal justice reform. I mean, there's a civil rights element, I think, that the next governor is going to have to play as well. But those are kind of the four areas that I see as absolutely central to the next administration.
And I do want to talk about a little bit of each of those as we go on. But before we do that, I do want to talk a little bit about the budget, because history tells us the next governor is going to face at least one economic downturn that leaves the state facing a revenue shortfall during their term. How would you approach such a situation to balance the budget if you wind up being down $300, $400, $500 million going into a budget cycle?
Yeah, no, I mean, I lived through this during the downturn of 2009 when Governor Markell came in, and then, you know, $800 million shortfall within a few months of taking office with the new DFAC projections. Like, I think there's a couple things. I mean, there's obviously places that we can tighten our belt, and there's kind of reductions that can happen. At the same time, there's a whole bunch of investments that we need to make that have big returns in the long term and will save us money in the long term. You know, we still have a 1950s budget in a lot of ways where we're paying for the consequences of not having better schools, not having better healthcare outcomes, not having better community safety. And so, you know, I want to make sure that we're smart and really kind of transforming the way we think about the budget. You know, right now, if a legislator proposes, say, a new program, the way that that's evaluated in the legislature is they only look at the costs. but they don't look at the benefits. They don't look at the cost that it offsets. They don't look at the cost that it's going to save in the long term. And so if you actually start looking at some of those calculations, you make different budget decisions. And then at the end of the day, if we really diversify our economy the way that I hope to around clean energy, biopharmaceuticals, fintech, sustainable chemistry, I mean, there's a whole bunch of opportunities to create more jobs, to create more revenues, to be more predictable and more sustainable. So we're not in this kind of massive cycle of wondering what a sheet is and what, you know, what the what's coming out of some of the more less predictable revenue lines.
So you've talked about a number of different issues along the lines. So let's try to delve into a couple of them. We'll start with affordable housing. Where and how do you feel the state can be most effective at addressing it? And I guess maybe the broader question I'm trying to ask is this a big solution issue or a creating a toolbox of solutions type of issue?
Yeah, it's both.
Okay.
How's that for an unsatisfactory answer? political answer. No, like, I mean, like, our housing stock ownership has changed dramatically in the state over the last 30 years. We have a larger percentage of our home units that are owned by investors or like second homeowners than almost any other state in the region. And so when you have a lot of out-of-state folks that are buying up properties for renting them or leasing them in different ways, it changes the economics. And so part of the affordability kind of challenge we face right now is folks are jacking up rents very, very high because they're just trying to maximize profit, mm-hmm. but they're not invested in the community. And so there are things we can do around that. There's some conversations around like rent stabilization and some things that they've done in many, many other states across the country. The second piece is that it's pretty hard to build affordable housing in the state. But if I want to build high density infill development near transit, you know, in Newcastle County or near the transit station on Route 1 down in the coastal communities in Sussex, it's incredibly hard. It's easier to build that massive subdivision on a farm field in the middle of, you know, nowhere with not a lot of infrastructure than it is to actually put dense units in where people live and where they work and where there's actual infrastructure and actual jobs. We need to make that easier. It's a different way of thinking about it, but I think at the end of the day, we need to make sure we're removing those government barriers, a lot of which are well-intended, to make it easier to build affordable housing. And it shouldn't be removed for everything, but it should be removed for things that have a public good. Because, you know, right now we're going to need 25 to 30,000 additional units. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the third or fourth highest rates of eviction and of foreclosures in the country. And so I think that there is absolutely a need for a toolbox, but you're going to need a governor that's saying, look, we're going to go big. And we're going to say, like, if there's NIMBY decisions in some places that say, like, look, we're not going to allow affordable housing, there should probably be an override. So I just, like, there's this is a crisis that statewide is going to require a statewide solution.
So let's talk a little bit about education. When we spoke in May, you did express support for the recommendation in the education funding report produced last fall after the education equity lawsuit for funding, calling for an additional $600 million to $1.1 billion of spending per year. In the wake of that, since we last talked, lawmakers did create a public education funding commission to look at the funding structure in the coming months. How much would you expect that group's findings to inform your approach, or do you feel like you have a vision right now that you would like to implement day one?
I want to make sure that the timeline matches like the politics, mm-hmm. because my fear is that if the recommendations don't come out until October, all of a sudden those recommendations don't become before the General Assembly until an election year. And I worry is that, you know, in an election year, folks are going to be hesitant to raise taxes. I really think this has to be a centerpiece of the first year agenda and the very first year of the General Assembly. So I want to work with them. The way they've designed it is absolutely brilliant. The composition of the partners and kind of who's at the table, I think it's really well balanced. I just want to make sure we're moving those recommendations up as soon as possible so there's a chance to vote on the recommendations before next June 30th.
And when we talk about education funding and equity, I believe when we talked last time, you had suggested that you're not necessarily interested in scrapping the unit count, but trying to find a way to build on it and change it in terms of things like weighted funding and making it different than the kind of antiquated system that it is right now.
Yeah, exactly. Correct? So if you look at the report, I think it's like page 150 something, there's a table that looks at kind of the shortfalls for each school district. And the thing that's amazing to me, unlike a lot of schools, and I was talking to one of the consultants that helped write the report, usually there's some places that are well overfunded, a lot of places are underfunded. In Delaware, everyone was underfunded based on the formula. So you can actually keep the unit count completely consistent and then have an additional pot. And it's kind of a foundation, if you will, that then is distributed based on the equity formula, based on the needs of the students. And that puts us in a position where no one feels like they're losing. Because I do worry about, you know, folks feeling, oh, well, you're taking this from us. And if you do it the right way where folks don't feel like they're losing anything, but they're actually like everything's getting better, then all of a sudden there's more buy-in. And I think, you know, one of the things we have to realize too is that because of our antiquated system of property taxes that's obviously going through changes right now, some of the wealthier properties in the state are actually properties that aren't owned by residents in the state. And so, you know, as those revenues come in, that helps defray the impact on year-round residents that you know, otherwise would see increases. And so, you know, I'm really excited because I just think these conversations are finally converging and you have political leadership in both the House and the Senate and, you know, kind of the committees and appropriations administrations that are willing to make this a top priority. I think the crisis has reached such a tipping point in education that the next governor has to be willing to lose re-election and do the right thing.
I want to move on to healthcare, specifically cost and access, which are becoming really stubborn issues. Delaware has one of the highest costs of care in the nation while struggling to attract and retain providers and specialists. What would you advocate in terms of prioritizing addressing the issues of cost and access in healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, up and down the state, I mean, I hear this everywhere, right, where there's just insufficient, you know, the costs are too high, but also the access issue is such a big issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, recently I was told by some folks down in Sussex that, you know, BB and Bay Health are actually reducing some of the maternal intake kind of capacity, which obviously is kind of devastating sort of thing, you know, yeah, kind of outcomes for children. And the big problem is that, like, we do have a culture that we've kind of set up over many years that rewards kind of consolidation and prevents any kind of competition. Like, I think we have to open up the market a little bit. And, you know, we have something called a certificate of need, that, you know, kind of requirement that you have to basically show that there's a need for whatever service is being added. It was a way to kind of control costs in the 1970s. It hasn't kind of borne out that way. Most states have already, the federal government had it for a little while. They got rid of it. Most states have gotten rid of it. We haven't yet. And what it does is two things. One is that you have to ask to add, but you don't have to ask to reduce. And so all of a sudden, there's nothing saying, oh, no, we need that service, even if it requires additional public support to provide it. And if an outside provider wants to come into the market, the incumbents can kind of say, oh, no, we already got that covered. What that does, like, I mean, not to sound like an economics professor, but anytime you constrain the supply and the demand is increasing, prices are going to go up. Right? I mean, it's just the nature of kind of inefficient bureaucracies. On top of that, we created some state level incentives in 2012 that basically made it easier to consolidate for the nonprofit hospitals, but didn't give the same benefit to some of the for profit providers. With all that in the backdrop, I mean, I just think the real big conversation we have to have right now is kind of starting with the outcomes. And I had a great conversation with kind of the mobilization groups the other day. That are trying to think about kind of community-led health. And the inequities kind of even block to block, right? Mm-hmm. Folks not being able to get to general practitioners, right? Folks not being able to get to, you know, specialists. It just requires an entirely new assessment. And I'll give, you know, Matt Myers has been talking about the medical school. I think, yes, like, long-term, I think that's interesting. I mean, I think it's, you know, how you get there. I mean, the states that have done it, it's taken a few years. I think we got to buy doctors now. Let's go out and find the best and brightest. I mean, for $20 million over a handful of years, you could attract some of the most talented folks in the country that if they spent 5, 6, 10 years here, they may spend a career here. BB's got a program right now for, like, in a residency. They're trying to figure out, like, how to have housing on campus because mm-hmm. Folks can't afford housing in Lewis. Right. But I think we're going to have to attract people actively, and we can't just hope the market clears, because it's just not going to without an active government.
I want to talk a little bit about climate. Obviously, the state has taken some steps to address climate change. Climate Change Solutions Act, calling for the zero net additions of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by 2050. There's the Advanced Clean Cars 2 program, calling for 82% of new cars and trucks sent to Delaware for sale be zero emission by 2032. Also, some initial steps toward procuring offshore wind energy. I know you support all those things, but what do you say to those who are balking at these efforts, bemoaning mandates, government overreach, and things like that?
Yeah, I think Delaware is kind of uniquely vulnerable to climate impacts. And we have to lead, right? Because folks will say, like, oh, it doesn't matter what we do here because they build one coal plant in China, then that offsets mm-hmm. the emissions that you can save in Delaware. The problem is that if everyone has that attitude, we end up with this, like, kind of race to the bottom that we're kind of on now. You know, we're nowhere near where we need to be to even meet the 2030 targets, let alone the 2050 targets. I want to make the case that it's in our economic interest. You know, we made a very significant shift from, you know, getting away from coal when I was secretary, and that's actually lowered prices overall because of renewables and you know, some of the gas we still have online is cheaper than the coal that we replaced. And other places that are still dependent on coal are seeing massive increases in their energy prices. We haven't had that here. I think we got to make sure that things like offshore wind and solar and other technologies are cheaper than the market. We can do that. If you amortize the cost over the lifetime of them, absolutely is. You know, we're in a position right now because of the incentives that I was fortunate to be able to work with the president on for the Inflation Reduction Act, that, you know, we can get the kind of levelized cost of clean energy cheaper than fossil fuels right now at scale, and do that in a big way that, so it lowers our prices, creates a bunch of local jobs, and also helps fight climate change simultaneously. As a corollary, there's also huge opportunities for us in, like, the green hydrogen space. One of the things that I want to be careful of, though, is that I do think we have to bring people along with us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have, you know, kind of raised some concerns about the way that the Clean Cars 2 kind of standard is set. We're going to be required under that standard to have 43% of the vehicles that are introduced in Delaware for sale in the fall of 2026 for model year 2027 BEVs. It doesn't just, like, kind of go to 2032 and then kind of jump right. up. Mm-hmm. There's, like, this annual ramp. Right. We're less than 10% sales right now. And so the question is, like, how do we kind of revisit that and simultaneously make sure that we're actually putting the incentives in place that folks want to buy them. I'm very worried right now that, like, I don't want to see them as, like, Democratic cars. Folks should want them because they're cheaper. You don't have to go to the gas station anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the headache of not having to go to the gas station every 300 miles or 200 miles. They're cheaper to operate. There's an upfront cost difference. There's an affordability issue for lower-income folks that, you know, can't afford that $25,000 EV. But I want to make sure that that folks are choosing voluntarily to buy them, not feeling like it's being forced on them, because I don't want them to resent their vehicle. It's not a mandate the way it's written, but it feels that way to people. Mm-hmm. If folks feel forced, they're going to resent it for a generation.
In a time when there seems to be stronger distrust of government, calls for more transparency and accountability, what role do you feel the governor's office and you personally can play in giving people a sense that they're getting greater transparency and accountability from their government?
I think we need to overhaul the system. I think it starts with the campaign finance system here. I mean, the number of holes in the system, you know, the role of, like, developers buying, you know, votes on county council or on, you know, in Sussex or in Newcastle, the role of lobbyists on the floor and, like, the Delaware General Assembly. I mean, there's just the amount of perceived pay-to-play action in the state is killing us right now. And if you look at places that have seen Republican governors win in Democratic states, it's places where the corruption argument kind of took hold. And so, you know, I think for the governor, I think a lot more transparency. I think obviously the money in politics. I mean, I'd love to move to a system of more public financing like they have in Maine and Arizona and Connecticut and Maryland and a lot of other places across the country. We can do that very low cost. I mean, it'd be, I don't know, 0.03% of, like, the state budget and actually have a robust program to get a lot of the money out of government, out of politics. I think there's also distrust from the lack of transparency. And this is another area where, you know, the way the FOIA has been interpreted, the Freedom of Information Act has been interpreted in Delaware, is very, very narrow. My motto at DENREC was basically just give them everything, right? Like, let them have it. And if we made a mistake, own up to it and move on. But, you know, like, I do think that the fourth estate has an incredibly important role to play. I think citizens have a right to data about the health of their community. With all the new digital tools and some of the AI tools, I mean, the ability to get information out quickly so you don't have to have, you know, lawyers poring over things for days is going to be much easier. But I just think we need to go absolutely full transparency, you know, kind of across the board if we're going to restore confidence in state government.
There is obviously this idea that's been out there for a while now of an inspector general for Delaware. Would you support
100%, something like that? Yeah, I actually think that's a great example of something that should have gotten done this legislative session. It had the votes. It just gives people confidence. But, I mean, if we had an inspector general, you know, maybe some of the scandals of the Department of Labor would have been uncovered earlier. I just think it was such a no-brainer, right? And the fact that it first, given some of the things we funded in the budget last year, the fact that that fell out, I think is just another failure of leadership.
That's Democratic candidate for governor Colin O'Mara. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. And that's a wrap on this special edition of The Green. The interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, our candidate conversations producers, Ethan Grandin, Jeet Hanselin, and Robert Stice, and Delaware Public Media senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again this Friday on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.